Good morning, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, November 16, 2011. It is now 7:01 p.m. Central Standard Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we do invite you to call 888-773-4496. That's toll-free, 888-773-4496. This evening, we'll have as our guest, once again, Andy Sutton, economist and chief strategist for Sutton Associates, who will be discussing world economic activities and how it directly affects you. Please call in with your questions or comments. Don't be afraid. You will not be interrupting us. And there's no such thing as a stupid question. Even if you disagree, please let us know. Okay? And I believe Andy's on the line now. Let's see where he is. Good evening, Andy. Is that you?
Hey, Joe. How you doing?
Fine. You sound like you're an old record. You sound like you're distant. Are you on a different type of phone than you normally are on?
No, just a regular landline.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. It may be on my end, so we'll just continue. Andy, thank you so much.
I thought you were going to say I sounded like a broken record. That's probably true also.
Well, I want to thank you so much once again for being our regular guest the third Wednesday of every month. We ask that our listeners do call in with their questions and comments and criticisms as well, or disagreements to 888-773-4496. And, of course, your comments are always welcome to comments@libertytalkradio.com. We will respond to each one of them personally. Andy, I guess everything is fine now. There's not really much to talk about.
No. Everything's been fine for about a year. The Eurozone is fixed.
Great.
There's no inflation.
Right.
Oil's not over $100 a barrel. What else? Everybody has work, as much work and at the wage that they would like. Everything's fine.
Okay, well, that's great. Maybe we'll talk about the next football game. Well, Andy,
I thought we'd talk about cooking or something like that.
On your Sensible Investor, which is your paid subscription newsletter, which I look forward to every single month. It was the first section was very insightful in that it brought us through the government debasing of currency through the ages. And I was wondering, for the sake of our listeners, could you sort of summarize what you talked about in that newsletter regarding debasement of currency, starting all the way back with grain and how they tried to profit from the storage of grain, which was not really there.
All right, I'll give you about a 5-minute rundown of that whole situation. I mean, basically, you had this agrarian society, and this is going back several thousand years, and you had this agrarian society, and people were farmers for the most part. They grew different products, and grain was a popular example because you can actually store it for a period of time. Before it goes bad. Other things, you know, like fresh produce and things like that, this doesn't apply as much. But this idea that, you know, we would go to market and we would take the products from our farm and go to market and trade those products and, you know, barter in a direct exchange economy for the things that we needed. And that worked out okay for a while. And then people realized, you know, this hauling these bushels of grain or these baskets of, you know, corn or whatever the situation is really becoming cumbersome. We have to transport this stuff constantly, and it's becoming, you know, a drag on commerce, really. So what people did is they came up with this idea of, you know, let's have a grain repository. And you can, if you're a farmer and you have, say, I don't know, we'll pick a number, 100 bushels of wheat, for example, you can put your wheat in the grain repository, and the guy who owns the repository and runs it, you know, he'll take a bushel as payment for his service, and you know, you keep your 99 bushels there, and then he would issue paper tickets, scrip, and you could go out into the marketplace with the scrip, and the scrip represented a claim on a bushel of wheat or a portion of a bushel or however it worked out. And that was great, because then all of a sudden you had indirect exchange. The people started to realize, hey, you know, I don't need to exchange grain directly for, I don't know, olives or whatever the situation was. I can use this scrip as an intermediary, as a money. And it was a money. It had perceived value. It was a store of wealth. It met all the criteria. Until the grain guys, the repository owners, got this great idea in their head to say, hey, all right, well, what if we just issue, we have 1,000 bushels of wheat, what if we issue 1,050 scrip notes? And we'll keep the additional 50, and we can use those to go into the marketplace and buy things that we haven't worked for. And that worked for a little while until people started to try to redeem these scrip notes. And you know, all of a sudden you have 1,000 bushels of wheat and you have 2,000 or 3,000 claims out there, and all of a sudden you have a problem. And, Joe, this is something that, you know, this wasn't just grain. This was going on right after our country was founded. We had silver-based banks. We had the First National Bank. That failed because of overissuance. We had the Second National Bank, and that's where Andrew Jackson got involved. He hated the central bank, Jackson did. So what do? They defame him by putting his face on the $20 Federal Reserve note. they defamed that man by putting his face on that bill.
Yeah.
Same with the rest of them.
Yeah.
So these guys, this has been going on for thousands of years in various shapes and forms, where you have, it's a cycle. You have a situation where something's set up, it's abused more, the people finally wake up to it, and it was always the redeemability thing that got them beat.
Right.
And, you know, it got, these silver banks got blown out because there were so many bills out there, and then the government would always let them off the hook. And it was, this was even the private banks, you know, going back into the, you know, the 1800s. There were state banks all over the place, chartered all over the place. There was very little regulation. All these guys were over-issuing. They all did the same thing. And they all went bust, and they always ran to the government, and the government always said, no, you don't have to redeem. They always let them off the hook. So this was the pattern that was laid out from early on. And when we got a Federal Reserve, we got another central bank, the third central bank. And, you know, Joe, I'm really hoping it's three strikes and that's the end of the central bank thing, because we're on the third strike now with these, with this nonsense.
Yeah.
But anyway, when we got that, we still had redeemability. You know, we had bills you could redeem for silver. You could take a bill, a $20 bill in, and redeem it for an ounce of gold. You had redeemability. That disappeared in 1933, by and large.
Right.
And then slowly, you know, between then and 1971, this idea of the connection, the backing of the currency with something tangible, that slowly disappeared as well. And ever since 71, we've been running just basically off total fiat. It's worth something because we say it's something, you know, and this kind of thing. There's no redeemability whatsoever, and the buffaloing campaign that's gone on to convince people that this is okay. We do not know history in this country.
Right.
You can go in any public school in America, and you ask the kids about this, seniors, high school, they have no clue.
Right.
It is not taught. None of this stuff is taught. Murray Rothbard's history of banking in the United States from, I guess, it's 1760 to the creation of the Fed, whatever the years are on that title, that should be mandatory reading.
Right.
Because it lays out all the stuff that went on during that period of time. You know, we had the Continental. That was, you know, pre-revolution.
Yeah.
They had problems with that.
Yep.
You know, it's always been the same story. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. It's always the same story. These guys always devalue. They always take away your redeemability. And when push comes to shove, the government always stands up for the banks. And that's exactly what we have going on here with TARP. People were outraged at TARP and TSLF and all these other facilities that were put in place to save the banks. Why should they be? That's our history. That's what we've always done in this country. We always defend the banks at the expense of the little guy and at the expense of the economy. And that's basically what the gist of that whole thing was. But the bigger picture of that, and I don't want to monopolize this whole thing here because I want people to call in, but just to give a monopoly, a rundown on, you know, that article, basically I explained why we can't do another Paul Volcker. You know, why we can't go in and raise the Fed fund rate to 18% again and 20% like it was back in the early 1980s. You know, there's a lot of good reasons why we can't do that, and that's basically what the whole gist of that article was. It can't be done. I mean, it could be done, but it would destroy pretty much everything at this point if we were to do that. We've lost our flexibility.
Well, is there any indication that the any history of any country issuing a fiat currency that has lasted any length of time and remain relatively constant, or is that story just about consistent with every country?
This is pretty much the same across the board. The predisposition of central banks and governments. See, this is the thing. You know, there's a lot of people, and I'm one of them. I think we should abolish the Federal Reserve. I don't think we should just audit it. I don't see a Federal Reserve in the Constitution. I think it should be abolished.
Yeah.
The problem is, if we give the power, the monetary power, back to Congress, they're also human beings. They're also given over to greed and avarice. They're going to do the same things. The idea here is that at least if you get it back into the control of Congress, there's more direct accountability. But this story, this movie, if you will, has gone on in so many places. You know, obviously the biggest catastrophic failure, you know, is the Weimar Republic and the Deutschmark. That's the biggest one. Zimbabwe is another big example, although it's not as well known as the fall of the Deutschmark. But fiat currencies are devalued over time.
Yeah. Now,
and it just depends on how long it takes them to reach the end game.
Yeah.
That's really the biggest difference.
Apparently the Deutschmark, although everyone knows about the Weimar Republic, that was done intentionally, apparently, so that Germany could pay off its debts to its foreign captors, being England,
yeah,
the United States, and Germany.
World War I.
Right. After World War I, they said, you want us to pay? We'll pay, but we'll pay you in worthless currency.
Right.
And, of course,
yeah,
one thing led to another, and then you had war again. So, but there are people who say, well, you know, we've tried the silver standard. We've tried the gold standard. It never works. Why should we do it again?
I'd love to talk to the people who think it never worked.
Well,
there's a lot of people that will say that it never worked, and the reason it didn't work is because it was sabotaged. Because, see, again, it comes back to the idea, this whole idea of printing scrip and then devaluing it, over-issuance, inflation, this has been going on for thousands of years. So anybody who studies history knows what has gone on. And so if you're going to have an honest monetary system, you're always going to have people that are going to be out to destroy it. They're going to be out to undermine it. They're going to be out to sabotage it. There's nothing wrong with you could have a currency standard that was backed by, I don't know, English walnuts.
That would be expensive.
But the thing is, the idea there is you can't print English walnuts off a printing press.
Right.
It's a scarce good, and that's one of the things that you need to have for a money. It needs to be a scarce good. It needs to be produced as a result of labor and the expenditure of capital, you know, much in the way gold is provisioned. You know, gold just doesn't show up at the doorstep. We have to go out and we have to work for it. We have to put people to work, expend labor and capital, scarce resources, and do these economic types of activities to get it. So it takes work. So it doesn't come automatically. And then you use something like that as a money because it can't just be reproduced from nothing. And it invokes discipline. If you have a gold-backed currency and you say for every ounce of gold that sits in reserves, you can issue $20, Well, then it's real simple. If you want to have more money in your system, then you have to find a way to get more gold. You have
right.
to run trade surpluses and, you know, do these types of things. Or you have to go out and expend more land, labor, and capital and get more gold. But either way, it requires work.
Right.
You know, there's effort that goes into it. You don't just, you know, say, okay, you know, we're going to do $1 trillion today and hit a keystroke on a computer and boom, you got $1 trillion. That's
right.
not money.
Well, you know, what I hear you saying is that people are unfamiliar with our monetary system and the history of our monetary policies and system, which leads me to think of, well, why not? Well, they're not because it's not taught in school. Well, why not? Well, the schools basically are dictated by, the curriculum is dictated by the government. And, of course, the government would not want to advertise or teach students that, hey, we really screwed up before and we're screwing up again. You want to see how bad it is and how bad it's going to get? So they withhold information. We are not educating our children. We are, in fact, teaching them a falsehood. And then when everything goes to heck in a handbasket, they can blame someone else. And the populace is left out to dry, saying, well, I guess that's the way it is. In other words, there's no thinking involved. There's no historical backing. There's no historical data. So we always seem to go back. Where's the problem? Well, the problem is the government. And it starts with the schools and our children. It seems that so many of our problems are that way.
Well, and you have to understand too. It's not even just the government. I mean, you have, you know, this is why, you know, I've gotten more positive responses to this latest article and this idea of a financial or banking driven coup d'état than the first time I floated the idea. So people are starting to understand that this is what is going on.
Yeah.
There are folks out there, and they've already routed several countries. You know, Argentina is a prime example. They've routed several countries now, and right now they're working in the Eurozone, and they're doing it because they hooked these people on debt, and the people sign the bottom line. That's it. That's, you know, the end of the story. You know, people will say, oh, we're taken advantage of by the banks. No, whose name is at the bottom of the page? Yours.
That's right.
You know, and this is, you know, people just lack this whole sense of personal responsibility. But anyway, I mean, you have these entities that are basically roving about, you know, just devouring these countries. You know, this whole Eurozone thing, that's all this is. You know, they're talking about, you know, the bigger this bailout fund gets, the happier the financial markets are. That's because that bailout fund is for the banks. It's, you know, it's not for these economies.
Right.
You know, it's not for the people of those countries. It's for the banks.
Right.
You know, as long as the banks are happy, things will be allowed to continue kind of sort of quasi-normally. You know, as soon as somebody says, you know what, we're going to have a referendum on this bailout thing, you know, like they did in Greece there a couple weeks ago, the markets can drop 500 points in a day, and it scares the daylights out of everybody, and they get their way. And that's what they did here in 2008. You know, they went on the floor of the House of Representatives, and they told these guys, if you don't pass this TARP bill, the market's going to drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another 2,000 or 3,000 the second day, and it's going to, you know, it's all going to break loose. That's what these guys were told. It was terrorism, and
right.
I'll go on the record. I'll call it that. That's terrorism.
Right.
What they did, and that was done by Henry Paulson. And where does he come from? He comes from Goldman Sachs.
Right.
Who was he? What official capacity was he acting in when he was issuing those statements? He was acting on behalf of the U.S. Treasury. But who owns the Fed? 12 banks, Goldman Sachs being one of them. I mean, really. All you have to do is connect the dots here. These countries are being routed
right
now. They're being looted. They're being taken over. And their future economic output is being basically committed to these banks.
Right. Well, Andy, hold that
That's
thought.
That's what's going on.
Yeah. Hold that thought, and we'll just stop for a second for station identification, okay?
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure libertarian talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased this evening to have Andy Sutton, economist and chief strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, as our guest once again, speaking on the economic situation that we have today and how it applies to us and what maybe we should do to protect ourselves. Please call in with your questions, comments, and your criticisms, your disagreements, 888-773-4496. Now, you will not be interrupting us or disturbing us, or there's no such thing as a silly question, 888-773-4496. Of course, your comments are always welcome to comments at libertytalkradio.com. Thank you. Andy, I'm like everyone else. I get bombarded with information on a daily basis, even when I'm not looking for it and I don't want to hear it, regarding the euro, the dollar, the price of oil, the price of metals, commodities, on a daily basis. And it seems like I cannot even hide in a closet, turn the lights off, go in the corner, and throw a blanket over my head, and I still seem to hear all this stuff. Now, if everything was running relatively smoothly, you would think that you wouldn't hear so much about it. And yet, you just can't seem to escape it no matter where you are. From the mainstream media, you don't get the whole story. You seem to get bits and pieces, and it all amounts to a tremendous amount of noise, no real information. What the heck is really going on with the commodity sector, especially with oil now? Why is oil all of a sudden $100 a barrel or close to it, when everyone was predicting it was supposed to go down to $70 to $65 to $55 a barrel?
Well, see, the thing is, there's a lot of money flying around. You know, they've printed all this money, and they gave it to these banks a couple of years ago.
Right.
And they bailed them out. They made them whole. And they were actually made whole several times over. Right? We've been through this before, so we're not gonna do that again. But you have a lot of hot money flying around, and it's going to find a place, and it moves. Sometimes, you know, it's in the bond market, too. I mean, if you look at the price of the 30-year bond, I mean, it's unreal. You look at the price of the 10-year note, it's unreal what's going on there.
Yeah.
So you got it. That's a bubble. There's no fundamental reason that there should be this huge demand for U.S. government debt. If we could just go down a rabbit trail, if you'll permit me.
Surely,
that
please. Yeah.
Latitude for a second.
Surely.
Today the Treasury came out with its statement on the public debt, and the Federal Reserve, get this right, the Federal Reserve is now the largest owner of U.S. government debt.
Now, that's not good.
Now, didn't I tell you that these guys were out to take over these countries a couple of years ago?
Right.
They're buying our debt. That means they own our country, or a part of it, not all of it.
Right.
They're the biggest owner above China. So you take the article here. I'll put it up on the blog so people can read it. I don't want to bore people with numbers. But between the Fed, China, foreigners, they own a huge amount of our debt. That means that the future economic activity of our country is going to be paid to people outside our country.
Yeah, but you're
now,
talking about the Federal Reserve. But you're talking about the Federal Reserve, and most people say, "Oh, the Federal Reserve is part of the federal government. It's part of us. It's just us borrowing money from us."
Absolutely
so no
not.
I know that. That's the problem. Please explain that. And by the way, callers, I know we have a couple of callers on the line, and you do want to express your opinion. Please hold on, because I'd like Andy to finish his train of thought first. Okay, continue, Andy.
I'll finish it very quickly. The Fed is a private bank. It's an admitted private bank. Anybody wants to take a look at the Act of 1913, they can go back and read it. It is a private bank. It's owned by stockholders. There's 12 main banks that own stock. All the members of the Federal Reserve System, your local bank, if they participate, which most of them, I think almost all of them do now, they receive a 6% annual dividend on their stock. This is all off the Federal Reserve's website. They are as private as it gets.
Right.
And they don't even try to hide it. And their stewardship was, or their mandates, I should say, was price stability and maximum employment. They've done neither. Look at the value of the dollar over their 98 year stewardship of the dollar. It's gone down almost 96%.
Right. And
terrible record.
The Federal Reserve is in fact owned partially by foreigners, not even U.S. corporations, but foreigners altogether.
Absolutely.
Okay. All righty. Would you like to take a call right now, Andy? Okay.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air. Your first name, please. Your question or comment, please. Caller?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am. Your name? And
Okay. I didn't know if you said you had two callers. My name is Steve in Michigan. I called before.
I'm sorry, your name again?
Steve.
Steve from Michigan. Okay, Steve, thank you very much for calling in. And your question or comment, please.
I was just wondering what you guys think about Greece and Italy getting new prime ministers that are part of the central banking system or world banking system. And on top of that, I read an article that they said there's 147 corporations that control all the other corporations in the world. Have you any more information on that?
Well, I can tell you about the two new prime ministers in Greece and Italy, and I wrote a piece on this last week. Yeah, exactly. They're exactly what you said. They're part of the system. They're part of the banking establishment. And I guess it was Monti over there in Italy. I saw a blurb come across the wire today that he's filling his cabinet, if you will, I guess whatever they call it over there. There's no politicians in there. He's filling it with bankers, executives, and I forget what the other category was, but there's foxes guarding these hen houses, and the people in the markets, this is great, they're gonna really get Italy into shape. No, they're not. They're gonna rout the country. This is what this is all about. They've already busted out a couple of these. Greece has busted out. And then they bring in their puppets to make sure that the job gets finished. This is what they do. And they're actually doing it in Argentina again. And these guys just got hammered a couple of years ago. So, that would be my only comment there. As far as these other big corporations controlling most of the smaller ones, if you take a look at who owns the stock in a lot of these companies, I don't know what the exact number is, but there's a lot of these banks have huge portions of stock in companies. So 147, that sounds pretty close. I don't know the exact number, but that sounds pretty close.
They there's a lot of conspiracy theorists and all about this one world government and all that. I just seems to me that there's a hidden world government, and it's a banking system. They control everything through corporations in controlling the governments. And it just seems like there is already a one-world government. We just don't realize it.
Well, I wouldn't
be
inclined. I wouldn't be inclined to disagree with that.
Yeah.
If you what people need to do, anybody who's listening, if you haven't done this already, go to your favorite search engine and try and pull up the quotes of the Rothschilds from many, many years ago, back in the 1800s.
Yeah,
they were huge players in the banking system back then. And they basically laid out what the ground rules were going to be as far as, what they would tolerate and what kind of conditions they wanted to have. And you just read that. And if chills don't go up and down your spine, then I guess you better go and, get some light pumped.
Steve, right,
thank you.
Yeah, Steve, let me ask you a question now. Are you concerned about what is your major concern right now as just a citizen of the United States? What is your major concern?
Our rights. I think we've lost more for our rights. I'd like to get our rights back, but I don't see that happening. I think we're way past the tipping point, part of no return. We have gone way too far. I don't see this coming back for years and years. And I don't know if the American people can ever get educated enough, because the news media is being controlled by these people, these corporations and all that. And you will not get the truth out. And I don't know how you're going to get the truth out to people.
Yep. Well, I guess as the Rothschild said, give me control of your currency and I care not who writes the laws. And I guess this is where
there
we are
go.
Right now. I think that's exactly where you are. Steve, I want to thank you very much for calling in and asking an insightful question. I'll just put you on mute, and you can continue to hold on and listen to the rest of the program if you'd like, okay? And if I have not already done so, Steve, if you'd like a Liberty Talk Radio T-shirt, just send me an email to comments@libertytalkradio.com with a mailing address and your T-shirt size, and I'll be more than happy to send you one, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hey, Steve, thanks for calling in. We do appreciate this.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, the way my brain works is it doesn't work all the time, by the way, Andy, in case you already know that. But when it doesn't. It just seems to go in Neverland. It seems that I become overly concerned with end games. I have friends who have literally seven-figure accounts in invested, and they watch the market on a daily basis. They're concerned about the slightest changes, the shortest trends. I never watch that, and I don't care about that. I'm always looking at what the end game is, and what should I do to protect myself against whatever that end game, perceived end game is? How should our listeners be looking at what's going on today? And am I just too cynical in the way I'm thinking?